In this episode of Skeptico, Dr. Robert Almeida reviews the evidence for a human consciousness beyond our brain.
The good news is that we can show that human minds do exist and are of a different order than physical objects as we know them. And that seems to suggest now that, in fact, the whole question of minds is not a question of metaphysics or religion. It's a question of science.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and we're joined today by a very distinguished writer, thinker, and professor of philosophy at Georgia State University, Dr. Robert Almeida. He's written many books, and they cover a range of topics from ethics to the epistemology of science to near-death experience. And as we were chatting about just a minute ago, when we get into ethics and the logic of philosophy, it can get a little bit technical, but I think we're going to have a really interesting chat. So, Dr. Almeida, welcome to Skeptico.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Great. Could you start by maybe telling us a little bit about your background and how your interests and your thinking led to some of the beliefs that you have?
Well, I graduated from the University of Pennsylvania with a PhD 35 years ago, and I taught at the State University system in New York for a few years and then moved to Georgia State University. At that time, I began reading and have always been reading in epistemology and philosophy of science, where I published most of my work. I've written on the American philosopher Charles Peirce, who had an interesting effect on me. And I stay current with contemporary American philosophy, epistemology, metaphysics, and things of that sort. I think Peirce and maybe Quine were important influences in my intellectual development. But somewhere along the line, I happened to just see this book, 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation, which I thought was a very peculiar a book. It was written by Ian Stevenson, as you may know.
Right.
And I took it down and I started reading it and I couldn't stop reading it. And that led to one set of beliefs that led to a certain kind of renewed interest in metaphysics, which I had abandoned. Simultaneously with that, there was new literature coming out, near-death and out-of-body experiences, and I started reading all that fairly briefly. So what we had was a new body of evidence emerging, or a new body of discourse emerging on traditional metaphysical problems, which in the case of the existence of minds or personality, that's supposed to be, at least traditionally in American thought, reducible to brain states or properties of brain states. I came to believe that there was good empirical or scientific evidence for arguing the case that indeed there are these kinds of Cartesian minds or souls, or as the ordinary man in the street says, my personality is not my body, sort of a story.
Right. There is the self. There is the ghost in the machine, as
the ghost in the machine, which has been systematically rejected by the majority of philosophers on the continent and here. Although recently there's been a big change, an interesting change in that. There are a number of recent books have come out on consciousness. David Chalmers' book, and then there's this Richard Levine's book. It's called Purple Haze, The Problem of Consciousness. And Professor Kim from Brown, who has a book entitled Minds or something very much like it. There has been this slow emergence of belief to the effect that since the 1920s or 30s, there has been this unquestioned conviction that the only things we can make sense of are those things whose causal activities can be explained in natural science. And so most of the people up until this very recent 20, 30 years have been fairly strongly rooted in materialism and that explains its popularity and its pervasiveness. If you wonder why, I think one of your questions was, if you wonder why materialism has had such a dramatic and deep effect on the academic world, it's because academics generally have a diminished respect for religious belief or simply people who have a lack of a scientific background or a lack of understanding of what science is up to. So they thought that, and this happens back in the 1930s, there was the positivist movement, which was primarily trying to make sure that we could end up with the kind of agreement that scientists have on major issues in the face of nothing but philosophical confusion from the beginning of philosophical discourse.
I'm sorry, that's a point that I'd like you to maybe delve into a little bit further, and that's that, you know, really the current state of thinking with regard to materialism, at least let me postulate this and then you can really tell me the truth, but it seems to be more of a reaction against an old argument of science versus religion versus having caught up with the new argument that it's not really about whether the Bible is factual or anything like that. It's about all these other experiences that we see in different areas of science that suggest that maybe there is a self, that suggest that this is something we need to investigate. And yet the argument seems to be stuck on a 100-year-old rejection of mixing theology into science.
Well, materialists have at least four or five strong, what they take to be strong arguments against believing in minds as distinct from bodies, or personality as somehow or another not reducible to brain states or biological properties of brain states. Those five arguments start off classically with, well, these theses are not empirically confirmable, namely that there are minds in God. So we have no justification for accepting them, since the only things we should be should accept are things that science can tell us is so.
Okay, so we can't test it is kind of the first theory.
That's the first one. And then what they'll say is, well, there are interesting cases where materialists will still say, well, you know, it is empirically testable. We can imagine that. But it hasn't been confirmed. Or the third, that would be Derek Parfit's book, Reasons and Persons. Or the third one would be, well, it has been tested, and science has shown that it's false. That would be something like John Searle. And then there are those who will say, well, look, we don't really need to appeal to minds, because after all, anything we want to explain, we can always explain by simply the physics of brain states, and believing in minds serves no real explanatory function when you want to explain human behavior. And then finally, the argument is that, well, if you believed in minds, they would not explain anything about the world, at least about your behavior, because they don't involve, as causes of human behavior, the transfer of kinetic energy from one object to another. So you have all these particular objections to the belief on the part of materialists, the belief that there are minds that could be causal agents distinct from the body, and although they would have to have something in common with matter to be able to affect it causally, you have all these, that would provide you with no way to explain anything. My reaction to all of this is that all five of those objections are bad objections, and I've just written something on it. Are bad objections, and there is good empirical evidence that, in fact, we have confirmed belief in the existence of human minds, irreducible to physical objects, and that has come from this area of research that I've called primarily, you know, the new stuff on near death and out of body, the best cases, and the same with the best reincarnation cases. There has been a persistent refusal on the part of the academic community to take seriously this body of evidence, and people just don't seem to be able to do it because it seems so associated with religion and so-called bad philosophy. Bad philosophy would be the philosophers who think that you can prove something or other outside the method of science. Materialism has really been entrenched. It's been a dull, boring story about reductionism that hasn't quite worked.
Right.
And it's getting more and more boring because now it involves cognitive science, which has all these promises made that will explain all your intentions, your desires, your belief, and your behavior by correlating neurological light-ups when people are doing this, that, or the other. And I think the promise of cognitive science has not come forward, and I don't think it will.
Well, and I think, you know, it's interesting. I think there's even some circles within the neuroscience community and especially in the psychology community that are starting to back off of that somewhat, too, and saying just because you've...
Yeah, well, I think I'm starting to smell it. I was at the National Research Center last year for a couple of years there in Paris, and a lot of them are very, very naturalized epistemologists and philosophers of science. But I see a number of people starting to move slowly in the direction of taking issue with the promises of cognitive science and materialism. You see even that going down at the University of Paris. I was lecturing at the University of Paris about a year ago, too. So I think the good news is that we can show, and this is what's pretty interesting, I think, from a traditional point of view, that that human minds, irreducible, souls or whatever, irreducible to brain states, do exist and are of a different order than physical objects as we know them. And that seems to suggest now that, in fact, the whole question of minds is not a question of metaphysics or religion. It's a question of science, and if we do our science carefully, we should be able to prove or disprove it. I know what I would take as disproving evidence in natural science for the existence of minds. I also know what I think would count for it, and I think I've argued for it. And that
Could you go ahead and make that case right here a little bit? I think that would be very interesting. What do you think is the strongest argument against the existence of consciousness and even the next step, the survival of consciousness? And what do you think is the strongest evidence to support the claim that there is a separate consciousness from the brain?
Well, I'm having a little difficulty sorting the strongest argument against the existence of consciousness irreducible. I think it's probably from scientists the idea that consciousness, if consciousness really exists, we have no way of understanding how, our mental states really exist. We have no way of understanding how they can cause human behavior. And so it wouldn't be useful for us, it wouldn't be relevant for our explanations of human behavior to appeal to consciousness, because consciousness wouldn't be a physical object conveying kinetic energy to another object.
Let me push forward with that a little bit, because it gets a little bit fuzzy, I think, for the average layperson, such as myself, to understand. What I hear you saying is that in science, we shouldn't appeal to other means to explain something that can be explained in the physical world that we could then affect in some way and make useful for our lives. Is that, do I kind of have it, or is there something?
Better yet, I mean, that's good. I think I'd want to say the underlying belief behind that is that the only causes in the world are those that are physical causes involving the transfer of kinetic energy from one object to another. But if there is consciousness, which is irreducible to a physical object as we ordinarily know it, then it's hard to see how they could be causes in science, so they couldn't explain anything that science wants to explain about the world. That's their one of their better arguments. My response would be, well, maybe there's a primitive kind of causality between physical and non-physical objects, and I've actually argued in different places that that is the case, and that we can show it.
What is the best argument for the survival of consciousness?
Actually, I think the best arguments for that are not simply the failure of all the anti-Cartesian arguments offered by materialists. Those five arguments I mentioned a little while ago, a lot of those are, I think they're all bad, and the failure there shows the inability of materialism as a whole to respond, to show that the alternative thesis to what they have in mind is very is unacceptable. Positive research, I think, is actually in the reincarnation research.
And let me stop you there for 1 second, because I want you to back up for a minute. For those of us, we haven't spoken very much about the Ian Stevenson research. I think it's tremendously compelling. I wonder if you could back up, give us some background on that, and maybe while you're at it, talk about why, even within this area of survival of consciousness, it seems that reincarnation is even the third rail in that discussion, too, and usually gets left out of the discussion.
It's unfortunate it gets left out, but it hasn't been totally left out. In his book, Reasons and Persons, the English philosopher Derek Parfit, who's teaching at NYU now, said he knew exactly what it would take to confirm the existence of minds as irreducible Cartesian substances. And he then described a case not unlike the cases that Ian Stevenson actually uncovered, only Ian's cases are much stronger. When he got done describing a case like that, he then said, this is what it would take to prove the existence of minds. If it were true, then we'd have to have very different views about memory than we have. We would have to change our way completely about human personality as having the continuity with the past lives and that sort of thing. He said, but we don't have the evidence. In other words, he accepted what it would take in terms of empirical evidence for saying there are minds in and through a discussion of reincarnation, because reincarnation is the hypothesis that makes a specific empirical predictions if it is true. It predicts that people will have these memories of past lives that you couldn't otherwise explain except by saying that they really did live a past life. Stevenson's work, I think, is careful, and I've seen a lot of criticism of it, which is not justified in my view. I think some of the philosophers who have criticized Stevenson were considerably less adept in philosophy than Stevenson is. I think that area of research needs to be funded more on the assumption that this is a thesis that is fundamentally empirical.
Explain for a minute exactly what Dr. Stevenson did and what's still going on with some of his other
Stevenson
colleagues.
Was a pediatric psychiatrist whose practice involved children, very young children, at the University of Virginia Medical School of Medicine. And people kept bringing their children and said, you need to fix him. He's telling these fantabulous stories, these conflagratory stories about having lived an earlier life. And that generally was thought as evidence for insanity, a certain kind of delusional behavior for many, many years. He was the first one to say, let's see if what they're saying occurred did in fact occur. So he left the office and tried to find out where these people described they lived and what happened. And he found an incredible correlation between the actual historical record and the memories of these 5 to 8 year olds. And as the story goes, he immediately set out to falsify them. He actually went to A.J. Ayer and sat down and with him at Cambridge University and said, I have these cases. Can you explain it? And by the way, that led to Ayer's book, The Problem of Knowledge, the fifth chapter in which he talks about the question. The book is called The Problem of Knowledge, still a paperback, which was out in 1956, actually. And that's where Ayer said, if you had somebody with all the memories of Julius Caesar and you couldn't explain how he got them in the usual ways, you would have to say that this person beside you is, in fact, Julius Caesar in another body. Most people pass that over. I remember noticing that very closely when I was a graduate student reading that stuff. Anyway, Stevenson then went on to do a series of investigations on people who reported having lived past lives in different parts of the world. He brought people with him. They copied what everybody said. He noted very carefully in fine clinical way the correlation between what the people said their past lives were and what they actually confirmed independently. He put boundary conditions on what kind of cases wouldn't be discussed, namely those where children could possibly get the information from parents or other people. He usually had to deal with facts that nobody at that time knew, and And, you know, he had this whole procedure, and it's very, it was very compelling. And he continues to do it. People said, well, this is only in India, and then he did books on things in Europe, and then he has Americans who remember past lives. And all I can say is my experience has been that while some people might take it seriously, most philosophers won't even look at the book. Most philosophers haven't quite gotten to it because, you know, that sort of makes of questions like human personality, the scope of and value of psychiatry, psychology, and the existence of minds an empirical question at the very root, and I think most philosophers are really uncomfortable about that. But I may be wrong. I may be wrong in that. I think, you know, I don't think we're going to get great progress in this particular area.
You know, actually, I think that's a lead into to another area that I really wanted to explore that you've written quite extensively about, and that's given that you might that there is this alternative worldview, this alternative paradigm out there, that there is such a thing as consciousness, and perhaps there is the survivability of consciousness. What are the implications for our ethics, our morality, and how we think about the role that we find ourselves in as
a
human race?
And by the way, I would say that the evidence is that consciousness does survive in some cases for some period of time, we know not how long, for some reason we know not why, and by some mechanism we know not which. The important thing is to recognize that some essential part of human personality that allows the body to have an interesting part of your personality, but some, the essential part of your would be surviving in those cases where you had the data. I'm not sure everybody survives. Everybody's consciousness survives. I don't think that's implied by the data. What's implied in the best cases is that these people survived. Why? I don't know. That would be a guess. By what mechanism? Well, we can't say in science, can we?
Well, I think that's a really important point, though, is that because so much of the time the debate ends there because the skeptics want to jump ahead and provide, well, then explain this. Well, we don't know. We're just saying that there's enough data to suggest that the existing paradigm needs to be questioned enough that at least some of these other theories can be explored. It really raises so many questions. It has implications across the board. It is not going to bring science down. The foundations of science aren't going to be destroyed. It's just a new area of inquiry.
One of the objections you'll often hear is it can't happen because we don't know how it happens, or it wouldn't happen under usual concepts of causality in science. I think that's a problem. I think what you have to say is the evidence is very strong that it does happen, but you can't deny that it happens simply because you don't understand why or how or for what purpose or for how long or which people. So I think that's a very modest claim. That's sort of like a minimalist reincarnation or survivalist thesis, which I favor, and which for which I've argued. But you're right. Now, the other point was, does this have any effect on morality and the people's lives? I think people who have had these near-death or out-of-body experiences seem to be much more comfortable in their skin, and they don't have the usual anxieties a lot of people have about dying and leaving the earth. But that said, I don't know that there is any way to show that people who believe in consciousness as irreducible will be somehow or other better or more sensitive or more loving or than, say, simple materialists who deny all that and at the same time still find good reasons for living, for being kind and helpful and good citizens and things of that sort. So I don't know that believing, or I don't know that people who are reincarnating would be better for that. There is a view that somehow or another, this is purely philosophical, it goes back to ancient times, the Pythagoreans, that somehow or another the purpose of reincarnation is to get better and better and go along, get off the wheel of rebirth and get reabsorbed in God. Well, okay, that's all philosophy. I don't know there's any evidence for any of that, you see.
Where I was really heading, and maybe you could address this, I think there are strong implications for the paradigm. I mean, if you are a materialist or if you're a dualist, I think it has to inform your worldview and how you think about all these issues about who we are, how we should be, how we should act, and our ethics. What do you think?
Well, one of the things we haven't pointed out, incidentally, is that this all has a very important implication on the nature of psychology. Psychologists think they're explaining human behavior when they correlate brain states and antecedent physical conditions, and I'm not sure that's what psychology is doing, or whether psychology is really explaining human behavior bias. But it'll predict and control a lot. As for the ethics of it, like, all I can do is repeat the point is, I don't know that if you believed in consciousness surviving death, that you would, in fact, have some special moral capacities or even be a better person than the crass, mad dog materialist who would otherwise take good care of her or his family and friends and have loving inclinations and a sense of honor that allowed for the highest standard views of morality. I think it would be very hard to say that dualists are better persons than materialists. Would materialists be slightly more nervous than dualists, committed dualists, because life is here today, gone tomorrow, and the trick is to maximize all the pleasure you can get in between? It might produce an aggressive search for happiness in the pursuit of various pleasures rather than a more relaxed. It might.
I think you make a good point, and I'm glad that you did kind of head it off there, because I was kind of headed in a direction that you make a good point that we can't necessarily go there. Great point, and a great way to sum up what we've been talking about. You know, as we wrap things up, can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on now?
Well, right now I'm finishing. I've been doing a 20-year book on knowledge and skepticism. And I finished it. I'm just trying to put the finishing. I'm just sending it off to be published. But I am going to go back into, I'm going to do a book on minds and bodies now. That would be a bit more sophisticated for philosophers. It would deal with some of the stuff we talked about, the objections to materialist objections to dualism. And I want to expand more to show that the kinds of usual objections materialists raise are just not very good, and make the stronger case less dependent on particular case studies of the sort that Stevenson and Osis and McCormick experiments on out-of-body experiments. Okay, well, listen, Alex, it's very nice talking to you, unless you have anything more you want to ask or say.
No, it's been a real pleasure, and I thank you again.
Thanks again to Dr. Robert Almeter for joining us today. If you'd like more information about some of the books and articles that we mentioned during the show, please visit our website at skeptico.com. That's skeptiko.com. While you're there, you can check out information on our other shows, drop us a note, get the number to send us a voicemail if you like. And by the way, I mentioned last week, if you'd like information on the upcoming new website we're coming out with called Open Source Science that will dig into researching some of the topics we talked about, just drop me an email and I'll get you a link to a pre-released version of that website, and you can check it out a little bit before it becomes publicly available. Well, that's going to about do it for today. Bye for now.